So, Herschel, you watched Atlanta?
Yeah. The four episodes, I think?
Yeah, the four that were out. The one that, and the fourth one is the first one again. No spoilers, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I loved it, but God damn it, I don't want to wait for next week to see Earn, Paperboy, Van, and Darius. But Jesus,
the first one
great
and the
story.
Fourth one, yeah, they were, they wasn't about Earn and them, but.
And the same, like, omen of death is in both of them, which is pretty cool. The fishing guy is the same as the pool guy.
Yeah, I thought that, so I was like, that looked familiar, but.
If you don't know what we're talking about, it is Atlanta Season 3 on FX, also on Hulu, which is where I'm watching it. But Episode 3, when they go to the death doula, that's pretty fucking crazy. That's pretty funny. Or is that 2 or 3? I don't know.
I think it was 3.
That
no,
was great.
2. I think it was 2.
That was great.
It was. The death doula.
So now they've, like, they've run across several different legends now in various
all the
forms.
Seasons.
Yeah. It's pretty funny. When they're in the UK, they're like, you know, we got some fire rappers. You ever heard of Splicky Dicky?
No.
You ever heard of Pucky Ducky?
Pucky Ducky.
You ever heard of 21 Savage?
Yeah, we heard of him.
Yeah, we know him.
And that was funny how they slid it in there. His artistic view, man, is...
Oh, that's good.
And they make
Don
no
Glover.
Fucking steak, though.
Fuck.
He's brilliant. That shit really happened that first episode. Well, except them black kids didn't escape.
Right.
The first episode.
Did it really?
Yeah.
That was a true story?
Yeah. But not nobody escaped, though.
I wonder if Cody and I covered it ever.
And as far as that dog go, I don't know about the dog, but I know for sure it was they drowned him.
Okay, so the little boy didn't walk back to his parents and say, is there spaghetti in the fridge?
Oh, no, that's okay. Everybody died.
Well, thanks for putting at least a little ribbon on it, Don.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He made it.
I don't know what happened to them other kids. I know the van was empty.
But they got out, too.
Yeah.
Because at the end of them, what's the name, they were showing them.
Oh, good. Yeah.
It's the only person that died. He put the dog. I don't know how he got the dog back in that motherfucker.
Hey, that's pretty good, though, because that dog was a little shit.
Because he caught it, so that means he would have to go get the dog, unless he has something to make it come back to him. The kid
was
smart,
though. So that was a ripped from the headline story, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, episode 4 is not ripped from the headlines.
We know that's
like a Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
That's like a
but I, honestly,
the scariest thing I've ever seen.
I think a lot of people... And I think that's why why we don't get reparations.
One day, there's going to be a fancy restaurant full of black people, and I'm going to be serving them tacos. It's going to be terrible.
Well.
And they're going to take 15% of my reparation tax.
Dude was telling them to take 15%.
Yeah,
he was doing the right thing, I guess.
The quote-unquote right thing.
Yeah.
Or the quote-unquote servile cishet white thing. Cishet? I can't remember what the words are anymore.
Man, I mean, that show is bogus. If
I love that show.
If I was on the white end of that, I'd be like, God damn.
Whew,
you
that
have
show's
to,
awesome.
You have to, well, I'm just saying, like, you have to look at your ancestors like, oh, you left this on us?
But the best part is he still understands it's not race at all, it's class. Because guess what? Mexicans, blacks, whites are all working together in the kitchen just like it is now.
They don't matter.
It's just some
race.
Of them got lucky and were... quote-unquote lucky, and their ancestors were enslaved, and now they're entitled to reparations. It's like, wow, you really fucking nailed it, Don.
Imagine,
you really killed it.
Imagine like Wells Fargo or motherfucking somebody, which they probably do.
Woo!
And TCF and shit. Well, fuck TCF, though.
They don't exist no more, right?
Yeah,
Huntington, Virginia.
It's a Virginia-based company?
I don't know. I know there's a town in Virginia called Huntington.
Huntington. So, yeah. Oh, okay, that's why you call it that. Is. I know
and actually, it might be Huntington Beach. I don't even know if there's a Huntington. I have no idea. Now I'm just talking about my ass.
Well, that's what we do here on the Bubble Butt Podcast.
XXXX. My name is Adam. That is Herschel.
Hey, Bob. H. Bob.
Welcome. All right, ladies and gentlemen. That's enough Atlanta talk. I'm done blowing Donald Glover for a while. Even though, goddamn, is he a triple
he a beast,
threat.
Bro.
He's attractive, he's hilarious, and he can sing.
That's, he can write, he can write, he can do stand-up.
Yep. All right, now I'm going to zip his pants up. Yeah, I've seen it, yeah. Because I love that Community, you know, that's
okay,
like my favorite show.
Yeah. Did you like his stand-up?
Oh, yeah.
That's what's up, man.
The only thing I don't like, really, is his raps. I don't think the
Childish
Gambino raps are but that one album that I'd showed you.
Somehow he makes it everywhere, though.
Oh, yeah. That one, like, oh, I'm not saying he's a bad rapper.
I know.
I'm just saying
you just don't like it, yeah.
But that one album, the, like, R&B funk album that I showed you,
woo,
I listen to that all the time.
I'm pretty sure there's some people out here that don't like Community or Atlanta, though.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Atlanta might be too much for people, though, sometimes. Like, yeah.
That show's, like, weird. It's deep.
Yeah.
It's a little uncomfortable at times.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I could see people liking it. Yeah, of course. I like anything that makes me cringe a little bit and think. Yeah. That's good stuff. Today's subject, Herschel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he shares the same goddamn name of 2 weeks ago.
No.
His name's Herbert.
Another Herbert?
We're doing another Herb.
Herb.
And they were born in the same year. This one is Herbert Richard Baumeister.
Mm-hmm.
Born April 7th, 1947 to Dr. Herbert and Elizabeth Baumeister.
Damn, a doctor, huh? You married to a doctor, god damn.
In the Butler-Tarkington area of Indiana. So we're not too far off, are we?
No.
You ever been to Butler-Tarkington?
No, I've been to Indiana, but not butt munchers.
Butt munching Tarkingtons? Yeah. Admiral Tarkington?
Yeah, never been there.
Who's Admiral Tarkington? Grand Moff Tarkington was from... in Star Wars.
Yeah. Which one? The original?
The old ones, okay. Yeah. Herbert got himself a sister in 1948 and a brother in both 54 and 56.
So two bros and one sis.
As the respected anesthesiologist Dr. Herbert kept climbing the medical ladder, his family moved to the wealthy Washington Township.
I wonder how long anesthesiologists been around. Because they make bread.
At least since the, like, 20s, 30s. They used to go around and they would have a mask that they would put ether in.
It's ether!
And apparently, it just sounded like a swarm of bees were crawling in your head and then you woke up later.
Damn.
Yeah. So, things get a little rattly.
Mm-hmm.
You pass the fuck out. You wake up, hopefully, that's without your tonsils.
I took melatonin before.
Mm.
That shit, I'm like, dude, don't want the people sleep because it makes your brain feel staticky.
Vance takes like half a one when he needs one. Like half a melatonin. Because he's like, one, and I'm not waking up the next day.
Oh, that's, damn, that's what's up.
I'll just sleep. It's like NyQuil for me.
Because it's supposed to be natural kind of thing, ain't it?
I just, you know, I just neck it right off that NyQuil bottle and then...
Yeah, hey, don't even measure it, just...
I throw that little shot glass away, that nasty little syrupy that, shot
dude.
Glass.
Just drink it.
Yeah. I know that I get like 6 mouthfuls per bottle. So as long as I ration it out that way.
Oh, so 6 gulps?
Yeah.
You get it done?
Yeah, 6 gulps and I need
so
a
you
new,
going through
a
bottles
freshie.
Like a motherfucker.
I should also say that's the Z-Quil, not the NyQuil, because NyQuil has Tylenol. You should be a little more careful with the acetaminophen. Because that'll fuck your organs right up. Young Baumeister's childhood seemed normal enough, but by the time he reached adolescence, something just wasn't right, and others were starting to notice. Close childhood friend Bill Donovan recalled that Herb would go on weird streaks where he'd wonder aloud strange stuff like, what does human piss taste like?
Ew. That's not like a joke, though, to be honest with you.
He would be normal, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Me and you talking the shit, shooting the shit.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would say, out of nowhere... Just like for a couple weeks at a time, you'd say weird stuff. And then go right back to normal, talking about football and stuff.
And I guess for us, that would probably be normal because we do it every week.
Yeah.
I guess for him, it'd just be...
These weren't millennials.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, they don't talk about that humor like that. Yeah, okay, yeah, I get that. You really had to be crazy then.
Pretty nuts.
Yeah.
Or now, or then. One or the other. Once while walking down the road, Herbert found a dead crow, pocketed it, and then plopped it on the teacher's desk when she wasn't looking. Irresponsible, forgetful, and volatile, teen Herb's fresh attitude soon caught the eye of his father, who, since it was the olden days, secretly took his son for mental treatment. After a long battery of tests, it was determined that young Herbert Baumeister suffered from schizophrenia.
Damn.
But that's where it seems to have stopped. Not the illness, of course, but there is no record of further treatment for Herbert.
Mm-hmm. Schizo.
They got their diagnosis. I guess Papa Herbert just figured his son could knuckle through it, could white knuckle through the schizophrenia, but that's not really how it works.
Nope.
You need treatment.
Yeah, especially if you're super far.
It's not something you can just sweep under the rug and hope that it goes away. And he's a doctor. He should know that.
No,
but he's an anesthesiologist.
Yes, it's a little different.
He's a sleepy doctor. Mm-hmm.
Just pump that fucking
putting that propofol all up in Michael Jackson.
And then in the spinal cord too, right? I think.
No.
I thought they pumped that shit up there.
There is some of them that they do that. Like, but they you may be thinking chemistry. Of your wife.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pregnancy.
And that's where they make the big bucks.
An epidural. Weird that's noise.
That's the sound of making epidurals.
That's what it sounds like when a needle goes to your spine.
It's accepting the
that
needle.
Sounds like when I eat a flute player's liver with a bottle of Chianti and some fava beans.
Just motherfucking.
Bowmeister's High School, North Central, was a bit of a sports magnet. Football and basketball were ways of life, of course. It's Indiana, after all. And Herb did not fit in. He preferred the company of books and could not roll with the popular kids. As far as dating went, nobody ever remembered him dating anyone in high school.
Actually, those are the guys that's winning nowadays. The geeks.
The nerds?
Yeah. The nerds Hell do yeah. everything. The nerds collect Jordans.
Hell yeah.
Games.
They make buku bucks now, you know? Those goddamn internet money.
For real. Pokemon, Yu-Gi-Oh, that shit is the end thing now. Anime, like...
Because they were like, hey, where did playing football get you?
Nowhere.
Jock. I'll tell you where he got you. CTE and student loans because you weren't good enough to get a scholarship.
Yep, sucks.
By college, he was just as aimless. He dropped out in his freshman year, but would return for a semester or two here and there, never graduating. Nevertheless, since Dr. Baumeister was a well-respected man in the community, little Herbert nepotismed his way into a decent job at the Indianapolis Star, the premier paper of the city of Indianapolis. Okay. One of the executives at the paper remembered Herb as overly sensitive to the way his coworkers viewed him, and he obsessively tried to show out and be somebody. No matter how hard he tried, how well he dressed, or how he talked, he just simply didn't fit in. Round peg in a square hole. One odd incident that happened at the Star, Herb offered to drive the executives and a few others with their dates to the Indiana University football game. On the day, all the execs showed up to the office expecting a limo, and Herbert showed up in a hearse complete with a chauffeur's hat. He tailgated people who got out of his way, obviously, and laughed maniacally every time. The execs didn't think it was very funny, and instead wondered who the heck this screwball was that was presently in charge of their safety. Eventually, it was on to greener pastures career-wise for Herbert. He left the Star where he'd risen as high as it was feasible for the...
For him.
For him, exactly. And went to the beautiful world of the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, another job his father's connections had landed him. Soon, he was ranting and raving at coworkers who were clearly not interested. His social cues weren't the best, however. He assumed they loved being lectured at by a weirdo. Despite his quirks, the Bureau of Motor Vehicles higher-ups recognized Herb's hard-working spirit and named him a program director.
Damn.
You'd think he'd start to fly straight after getting a pretty serious promotion, but his bizarre sense of humor, as his coworkers called it, ramped up and up with his title. Herbert began pissing on his boss's desk regularly, and although everyone, including the boss, knew who was responsible, nobody ever yelled at him.
Like, literally urine?
Yeah, pissing on his boss, like... taking a pee.
I thought you were saying, like, he was just pissing him off, like, you know, just the term for pissing.
Like just pissing all over
your desk, dude. Fuck you.
No, he was
actually pissing.
Yeah, drop trow, peeing.
Man, whipping dick and piss. All right.
And nobody ever yelled at him. At least not until he pissed all over a letter from the governor of Indiana.
How many people want to do that?
Probably everybody, right? At some point, everybody wants to piss on a governor.
Yeah.
Letter. A governor's letter.
Or a governor.
Or a governor. Yeah. Matter. Yeah,
it's all the same thing.
Let's not take water sports out of the question. In November 1971, Baumeister married a woman named Juliana Sater at the United Methodist Church in Indianapolis. Juliana had been introduced to Herbert through a mutual friend, and on their first date, they discovered they were both young Republicans with dreams of starting their own business one day. They're a couple of family ties, Michael J. Foxes.
I wonder how did what is she seeing this motherfucker to get with him? She didn't see none of the
like
corpse.
The desk being.
Yeah,
maybe she thought it was funny. Maybe that's what young Republicans do. You know,
they're ahead of their time.
Yeah, I have no idea.
With the dickness,
you know, George Bush used to like part of the Skull and Bones Club. He was in. He would like lay in the glass coffin, and dudes would come on it and stuff like that.
Like, I don't know how to think about that because they like. You ain't gonna come on you, so I can't say that's disgusting.
Yeah, but it's a dude like...
Yeah, nothing on the glass coffin.
Yeah. While you're looking at it. And you're in it. So it's like they're jizzing on you, but they're not.
They're not.
Listen, who knows what these young Republicans are fucking up to, buddy?
It's like filling on the back of a girl's seat.
Yeah.
Like, dude, what are you doing?
Like car seat? Like you're like sitting.
Yeah, they said that you sit. What? Nah, you rubbing on like assembly seat or something like that. Okay. Rubbing on the butt of the seat.
Okay, I got you.
Like, bro, what are you? I guess.
I guess, yeah. If you're Amish, that'll be.
Yeah. You're busting huge nuts from rubbing on wood and shit.
That's Republicans. Julie quit her job as a journalism teacher in the late 70s to focus on starting their young family.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, she didn't need to work, with her husband earning a great salary as program director for the BMV.
Mm-hmm.
In this boom time for the couple, they popped out three kids to complete their nuclear family. Marie in 1979, mm-hmm. Eric in 81, and Emily in 84.
Hmm.
When Herb soaked the governor's letter in piss and was fired, Julie didn't complain one bit. Instead, she faithfully returned to teaching while Herbert bounced from odd job to odd job, looking for his next path in life.
Mm-hmm.
Finally found a job at a thrift store and absolutely hated it. That is, until he realized the potential gold mine a place like that could be.
I mean, if you could find good shit.
He and Julie talked it over and decided to act on their young Republican dreams and open their very own thrift store called Save-A-Lot with a 4K loan from Herbert's mom.
Damn.
Save-A-Lot.
So he created Save-A-Lot? That's pretty decent. Motherfucker created Save-A-Lot and shit. Oh, Herbert and shit. I go to Save-A-Lot sometime if I need like...
No, you don't. You go to S-A-V-E a lot. This is Save S-A-V a lot.
Oh, okay. My bad.
These businesses no longer exist because they were founded by a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
Save-A-Lot would see $50,000 profits, partner with the Children's Bureau,
damn,
which provided free clothing for unfortunate youth,
mm-hmm.
and opened a second location all within the first year.
Mm-hmm.
Customers found the stores neat and tidy and commented that they only sold quality products at bottom dollar prices.
That's pretty decent.
By 1991, the Baumeisters were now upper crust businessmen, and their upper middle class home just wasn't cutting it anymore. The family moved to the hip Westfield District, about 20 miles from downtown Indianapolis. Here they purchased a property called Fox Hollow Farms, complete with a four-bedroom manor with indoor pool and a riding stable. This 18.5-acre property had been Julie's dream for raising a family on.
Man, schizophrenic is getting everywhere in life.
Oh, that's what happens when your daddy can just get you anything. Nobody wants to disappoint the great anesthesiologist, Dr. Herbert Baumeister.
Right. It was just probably a small town, too, so he's probably loved and through that whole...
If you're getting your appendix removed, you don't want to be the guy that pisses off. You don't want to be the guy that said no to him earlier about his son getting a job. It's all about laying those plans.
He ain't gonna save you.
It's all about planting that garden for the future.
But as a doctor, he has to save your life.
You mean the hippopotamus oath?
Hey, man, the motherfucker, man.
Things were not all as they seemed beneath the surface, however. Herb was uber controlling and called all the shots for the family, while Julie could barely do a thing for herself without permission.
Yeah.
A few times she left with the kids, on the ropes of divorce, but it never came to that.
Mm.
The beautiful property they bought soon reflected the inner tension of the family. The house was cluttered, floor to ceiling, and getting dustier by the day. Business associates at the time remember barely being able to find the front door because the grass was so tall.
Damn.
Julie would often take the kids to their grandma Baumeister's condo on Lake Wawasee for weeks at a time, telling everyone that Herb couldn't go with because somebody had to stay behind and run the businesses after all. So not only is she like leaving for her safety and mental well-being,
right?
She also has to be the cunt that says... Somebody's got to run the business, and I just got to get out of there. So Herb, the saint, has to stay behind
so
and run the business.
She making him look good.
It's awful, man. It's awful.
Is that what they always do?
Yeah. That's, yeah.
Supposed to make help their man look good, even though they probably beating the shit out of him.
It's brutal.
Yeah.
Speaking of marital problems, according to Julie, the couple only had sex maybe a total of 6 times in their 25-year marriage. And she never saw her husband fully nude. He would shower with the bathroom door locked, and the most undressed she ever saw him was in his pajamas as he hustled to the bed at night. He was ashamed of his skinny body.
But this is the person you married.
Yeah, but he's a son. We'll get into why. Listen, we'll get into why. It'll become obvious.
Yeah. But again, though, too, with me, if you married me, that's something you're not supposed to be worried about. If that's the
case. Seeing the naked body?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You put a ring on this, yep, sweetheart.
You're supposed to be a shit around him, fart around him, piss around him.
You saw the state this thing was in, yep, when you, yep, when you locked it down, baby.
Yep, I love it.
I got a few miles on this chassis.
That's what I like about love, though.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck, you see all my flaws, you still love me. Mm-hmm. Yep.
You can see the jewel.
Mm-hmm.
Underneath all these layers of fat.
For real.
Of course, just one of those red flags might send someone screaming the other way, but Julie was a very trusting woman and put complete faith in her husband. Mm-hmm. She was codependent and likely unable to even see the signs. It certainly allowed her to believe the most asinine alibi ever concocted in 1994 when their son Eric found a half-buried full human skeleton in the backyard.
What?
Julie waited for Herb to get home, anxiously biting her nails over what she would do. When Herb returned from Save-A-Lot that evening, he had a simple explanation. It had been his recently deceased doctor father's practice skeletons. He'd had it in the garage and finally decided to bury it one day while he was doing a little spring cleaning. As far as Julie was concerned, case closed. Back to business as usual.
That's what's up.
No problem. Your dad had a dissecting. Why not? He's a doctor. He's an old-timey doctor. Why wouldn't he have a practice skeleton?
He didn't question it.
In June 94... the mother of 28-year-old Alan Broussard was distraught. Her son hadn't been seen for a while, and that was not like him whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
In Indiana at the time, you couldn't even file a missing persons report until the person hadn't been seen for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
After that, the case went to a detective, and if he couldn't stir anything up in 30 days, the case would be kicked over to the Missing Persons Bureau to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
That's far too much fucking around when your loved one is missing. That's where private detectives come into play, who will begin hunting your missing person like a missing person from the beginning for
which
a fee.
Which is true, because, I get the fee because you got 30 days before they kicked it to the bureau. And how many days it takes to then even kick it to a detective to kick it to the bureau?
Yeah. It's 24 hours before you can file the case.
Automatically.
And then it goes how long? And then it goes in the hopper for a detective to grab it. And then he has 30 days to work it before it goes to missing persons.
You didn't have been and got over the missing person, buddy.
That person's a half a skeleton already.
I hope they changed it.
Me too.
Actually, I know it's a lot of states do the 24-hour thing.
Because most of them are runaways.
Yeah.
99% are runaways. This is a very rare case.
You don't want to waste police officer time from shooting black people.
Exactly. They are very busy. Do you know how many? There's black, like 14% of the country is black people.
There's a lot of black.
One of the most well-respected private eyes in Indianapolis was Virgil Vandegrift, a retired sheriff whose investigative team ran pretty much around the clock.
Mm.
You'd never have suspected the dignified salt-and-pepper no-nonsense Vandegrift would be as much of a techie as he was, but all of his gadgets were cutting-edge, and he had a rep for getting the job done.
Pay that money, then.
Vandegrift recognized a protective mother when he saw one, and he did everything he could to assuage Mrs. Broussard's fears. After all, most times, missing persons are just simple runaways with no foul play involved.
Mm.
Still, he kept his nose to the grind looking for Alan. He learned quickly that Alan had his fair share of demons. He was a heavy drinker with a history of anxiety and depression.
Mm-hmm.
He was also a homosexual in a community that didn't like a single thing about that lifestyle. When Vandegrift learned that Alan had last been seen leaving a gay bar called Brothers, he issued posters looking for information to all the gay bars in the city.
Brothers.
Brothers. Like Jake Gyllenhaal and,
So were they homosexuals?
No.
Jake Gyllenhaal?
I don't think so. From what I remember from that movie?
Brothers. That's what Tyrese Gibson...
One of them went to war. No. That's four brothers.
Yes, four brothers.
With Mark Wahlberg.
Brothers, they thought he was dead.
Dead. Yeah. So the brother marries the widow. Brother comes back.
You think that's bogus?
I just thought it was overly cloying. Overly emotional for no reason.
But do you think that's bogus?
Marrying a brother's widow?
Yeah.
I mean, they used to do it all the time back in Civil War days because, like, your brother made an obligation, started a family. Now that brother is dead.
Oh, okay.
So it's like somebody's got to step up and take care of his kids and stuff. I guess it was more common back before the internet.
Yeah, but definitely brothers is a little different. I don't want to say present day, but...
Well, it was like the Iraq War, right? Yeah. 2000.
That present day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was, you know what? Make all the movies. Eventually one's going to be good. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
I just won't watch them.
Make all the movies.
Just make them all.
Whatever you want to do, just put it in there.
Yep. And then somebody will say, dude, did you see number 35? And I'll go, hell yeah, dude. That's the best. I'm going to watch that now.
Number 35.
Although Vandegrift approached this case confident he'd find Allen as a runaway, and quickly, by the end of July 94, he was certain Allen had been murdered, and Indianapolis had an active serial killer on his hands. Three things occurred since the end of June that made him certain of this. Number one, Indianapolis real police detective Mary Wilson was working on disappearances of other gay men throughout the city, and all of them were similar to the Broussard case. Even their ages and physical appearances seemed to match.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, Vandegrift came across an article about a man named Jeff Jones, who disappeared the year before in mid-93.
He was homosexual, too?
The Gay Lifestyle magazine in which the article was published was picked up by one of Vandegrift's employees while scouting the gay scene looking for info. It reported that Jones, age 31, simply vanished into thin air off the Indianapolis streets. While digging deeper into the Jones case, Vandegrift discovered he had the same vices as the other victims so far. Mm-hmm. Anxiety, depression, alcoholism, other battery of mental illnesses. But number three was the most convincing to the salty private dick.
It's convincing.
In late July, Roger Goodlett, 34, left his mom's place one night to visit a gay bar. And like all the others, he too seemed to fade to another dimension. Just the same as with Mrs. Broussard, Mrs. Goodlett contacted Vandegrift because she didn't want to wait the obligatory 30 days before it got to the right people. Mrs. Goodlett recounted to Vandegrift Rogers' overly trusting nature and tendency to drink all the way to blackouts. It was like replaying Mrs. Broussard's description of her own son. Vandegrift knew there was a monster hunting a specific type of gay man. The team hit the pavement, checking and rechecking every gay bar. But of course, most of the clientele were afraid to talk to the police or anything resembling the police.
Because I'm pretty sure they still didn't want people to know that they was gay.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's like, this is my private life. Yeah, I don't want, I'm not like a sideshow freak. I don't want everything on display here. They did learn one spicy nugget, however. Goodlett had left the bar, Our Place, with another man with no real description and gotten into a light blue car with Ohio license plates. Insanely, the real police seemed disinterested with all this info Vandegrift was providing for free, but that didn't deter him in the slightest. This experienced old detective knew he was onto something, and he had enough intuition to understand how all this was connected. In August, just mere weeks after taking the case, a major breakthrough was made. An acquaintance of Roger Goodlett's, who didn't want their name out there for obvious reasons, saw one of Vandegrift's posters and believed he had some info that would help solve this puzzle. The acquaintance believed he'd been with a man who he was 100% sure was a serial killer, but when he told the police, they laughed him away. When he told the FBI, they said he was probably just on a bad drug trip. When he called Roger's mother from the number on the poster, she begged him to please hang up with her immediately and call Vandegrift. Over the next month and a half or so, the acquaintance visited Vandegrift's office several times, and each time his story unfolded more and more. It was clear that the acquaintance had in fact known and talked to the killer, and it was actually a miracle that he'd escaped with his life.
So he didn't do nothing to this motherfucker.
The acquaintance met the suspect at the gay bar, the 501 Club. What attracted him to the tall, lanky stranger was the extreme focus that he seemed to be placing on Roger's missing persons poster. Something in this guy's eyes, and the way he was captivated by the poster, told me he had something to do with my friend Roger, said the acquaintance. Certain this was the only path to answers, the acquaintance introduced himself. The suspect introduced himself as Brian Smart, and they had a polite conversation. Every time the talk steered towards Roger or the poster, Brian played dumb or pretended not to hear, but soon invited the acquaintance out for a night out. Brian said he was living in an empty house in town as he was a landscape artist from Ohio that was prepping a home for its next occupants. Let's go over there for a cocktail and a swim, he says. The acquaintance reluctantly accepted. He was very thirsty for answers regarding Roger. Outside, the two got into a gray Buick with Ohio license plates. They headed north and into what the acquaintance would call rich people territory up Highway 31 into the suburbs. They turned off at a paved driveway with a sign at the front. The only thing the acquaintance could make out in the dark was the word farms at the bottom of the sign. The Buick rumbled to a halt in front of a large Tudor-style country mansion, and they entered through the side door. There was no electricity on the upper floor, and every spare space was cluttered with boxes and items. Only a small walkway remained through all the junk, so it looked like a hoarder house, you know.
Those hoarders.
The acquaintance followed Brian Herbert through several... Oh, sorry. I wrote Brian slash Herbert, you know, because it's a fake name. Followed Brian through several unlit rooms until they reached a stairway leading down to the basement. "Come on," Brian said. "There's electricity in the basement." And led him down a large, well-lit rec room at the bottom of the stairs. Like the sprawling manor above, this area would be awesome if it weren't so filthy and cluttered. And to add another level of what the fuck, there were mannequins all over the room staged in various poses. "I get lonely down here. They give me some company."
Yeah. Like, dude, I'm out.
Yeah, I'm Grandpa Simpson. Yeah. I'm grabbing my hat off the rack and walking up the stairs.
Because it's already sketchy.
I've heard the Eminem song. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's 3 a.m. in the morning.
It's nothing good can come from 3 a.m. in the morning.
Not a chance.
You better off waiting till 4.
Wait till 4.
Yeah.
3's the witching hour.
It is.
That's where the worst stuff happens.
It is.
The acquaintance decided not to take the drink that was offered to him, and he saw Brian's face just ever so briefly contort into primal rage. He quickly got himself together and excused himself for the bathroom. When he came back, Brian was looser, louder, wider-eyed, and much giddier. The acquaintance had seen hundreds of people on cocaine, and it was pretty obvious to him that that's what he'd done.
Probably sniffing some coke.
Herbert Brian did successfully convince the acquaintance to take a dip in his quote-unquote employer's pool. As the two paddled around and chatted, the mood soon turned intimate. Brian had become very excited about a new neat trick he'd learned. And he went to the side of the pool to grab a hose.
Where's that hose going?
If you choke someone while you're having sex, it feels great. You get such a rush. You just use the hose to pinch off the carotid arteries, and it's such a buzz. You should see how someone looks when you're doing it to them. Their lips change color. That's how you know it's working. That's Brian. Brian Herbert said that. The acquaintance, listening intently but trying not to let his face betray him, now knew beyond a doubt that this guy Brian had killed his friend Roger, and who knows how many others. Brian jumped up, stripped off his swim trunks, and lay down on a fold-out couch, joyfully yelling for the acquaintance to try the hose trick out on him. As he slipped the hose around Brian's neck, Brian started masturbating. Afterwards, the two traded places. It was clear that Herbert slash Brian had done this many times before. His practiced hand cinched the rope around the neck with lightning speed. The choking became intense, and the acquaintance pretended to pass out rather than wait for the real thing. He felt Brian ease up on the hose, then heard him whisper his name. Next, Brian started violently shaking the acquaintance, who finally opened his eyes, grinned, and threw a little wink at Brian. Brian screamed, "You scared the shit out of me. People can die doing this stuff.
Yeah, bro.
There's been accidents." The acquaintance decided to be frank, responding, "Is that what happened to Roger?
Ooh,
was he one of your accidents?"
That was good. This is getting juicy now, motherfucker.
Woo! If Herb slash Brian knew what he was talking about, his face never showed it. He only stared back, presumably still high as fuck off that cocaine. Soon enough, however, Brian's speech became slurred, and he passed out on the fold-out couch. This gave the acquaintance time to snoop through the upper floor. He didn't believe Brian's story of being the landscaper here to prep the property. There were clothes in dressers and children's toys in all the rooms. This place had been lived in for quite some time. Now he had to find this fella's true identity, because Brian Smart sounds fake as fuck. Back downstairs and playing the most high-stakes game of Don't Wake Daddy imaginable, the acquaintance began rifling through Brian's pockets looking for his wallet. Unfortunately, this is when Brian snored himself awake. The two hung out for a little more before Brian reluctantly agreed to drive the acquaintance back into town. Brian called him a good sport that really knows how to play, and made him promise to meet back at the 501 Club next Wednesday for a date. Although the acquaintance wasn't sure of the exact address he was at, he knew it was either in Westfield or Carmel, which were very exclusive suburbs, and he remembered the sign said something farms. Problem was, there were at least 100 estates in those two areas that were called something farms. On the Wednesday of Brian and the acquaintance's date, Vandegrift set himself up inside the 501 at the bar while one of his detectives sat watching the outside for any cars cruising past that contained a long-faced, pale, brown-haired man. At last call, it became very clear the acquaintance had been stood up.
You think he was on to him?
Yeah. You know, I think maybe all those questions about Roger.
Yeah, he did. He came out. Does that happen to a little bit too much fun with dude?
Yeah. It's really strange that he let him get away, though. This was much bigger than a potential missing person, and Vandegrift went racing to the Indianapolis Police Department. Although earlier they had laughed the acquaintance right out of the station, Vandegrift knew there was one person who would take him serious as a heart attack, Detective Mary Wilson, who was already working on a number of missing young men. Mary Wilson was a career-minded grinder. She started as a beat cop and worked her ass off to make detective. She worked sex crimes where she learned and cataloged the pathology of rapists and sadists. When Mary got to missing persons, she said it was like finding herself. It was the purest form of police work as far as she was concerned. She had been lead detective on the Jeff Jones case, which is what springboarded Vandegrift to see the similarities between Jones, Roger Goodlett, and Alan Broussard. As it turned out, Mary was working a number of other cases with similar victims. Most recently, 20-year-old Richard Hamilton, 21-year-old Johnny Boyer, 28-year-old Alan Livingston, and others all the way back to the year 1990. And guess what? They were all gay.
I don't think that. I think we knew that.
Did we?
Yeah, I think so. What else would they be in this, their names?
Hey, that's a good call. Barry recognized the acquaintance right away for the missing link that he was. He'd spent and survived the night with a possible serial killer and was willing to talk about it. Even the juicy parts. Mary posted plainclothes officers at the 501, the Varsity, and our place, praying to just come up with a license plate number from this creep. But Herb was like a ghost around those joints lately.
He ain't showing up.
On the private eye side, Vandegrift sent one of his investigators to manually search the fancy estates looking for the right something farms. The investigator, Bill Hinsley, had been a state trooper for many years, and his journey had brought him to the end of a long driveway in Westfield marked Fox Hollow Farms. Bill Hinsley was already almost breaking laws just by being on the property, so he reported the large, unkempt, gross-looking estate to Vandegrift, who ordered aerial shots to be taken. Pulling the property record, Fox Hollow Farms belonged to a family with the last name Baumeister. When the aerial pics were shown to the acquaintance, however, he said that couldn't be it because the driveway looked far too short. Forehead. God damn it.
Well,
that was the place.
It was nighttime, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the place. That was the goddamn
place. They should have checked it anyway. It's worth checking.
They're private detectives, my boy.
There's only so much they could do. I get it.
They ain't no police. Herbert Baumeister continued to live his double life. His marriage to Julie was just peachy on the surface. And his two save-a-lots were continuing to succeed. But the strains of a sexless, joyless marriage were causing cracks that were starting to show, especially on Julie's end. She became distant and checked out. And by the end of 1994, both thrift stores had taken a financial plunge without her oversight. Julie was exhausted of being under her husband's thumb, and she threatened divorce, but never pulled the trigger. Instead, she stayed stuck in her own personal purgatory, strapped in for the steady decline of not only her marriage and businesses, but also her husband personally. At the Save-A-Lots, Herb was acting a lot like Hitler. He would walk around screaming, forcing employees to work 60 hours a week, and he damn near expected a salute every time he walked by. Damn. As far as his workday, employees say he would show up and yell, then disappear for several hours and come back fall down drunk, barking even more severe and degrading orders. One of the employees remembers from this time, everything was filthy. There was trash bags everywhere. It was like working in a landfill.
Damn.
While all this was going down, a whole year had passed since Vandegrift and Detective Mary had started their search to unearth the true identity of Brian Smart. The big lead they were looking for did leap out at them in August 95. The acquaintance was out at the Varsity Lounge on August 29th, fully resigned to the fact that he'd never see Brian again. Bam! There he was, strolling right through the front door. The two chatted and caught up, and at the end of the evening, the acquaintance managed to remember and record Brian's license plate on his truck.
He was coming back. He's horny. He ain't...
After a year?
He's horny.
365 days?
365 days?
52 weeks? Plate 75237 Alpha belonged to not anyone named Brian Smart, but to one Herbert Bowmeester of Westfield, Indiana. His address was listed as an estate called Fox Hollow Farms, where he lived with his wife and children. Finally, investigators were closing in just as Herb was starting to unravel. Mary, along with her boss, Lieutenant Green, approached Bowmeester straight up at his Washington Street Save-A-Lot on November 1st. Mary told him why they were there. They were investigating the disappearance of several young men in the Indianapolis community. He was a suspect, and they wanted his permission to search his property. Offended and looking put upon, he of course refused, saying all future communication would have to be through his lawyer. In the car afterwards, Green told Mary that he thought Herb was not only nervous beyond belief, but one of the weirdest guys he'd ever seen.
Which don't got nothing to do with shit. You being weird, though. Yeah.
You can be an Abed from Community and just be an innocent guy. Mary was a crafty prize fighter of a detective. Going straight up the middle right at Herb was the feint she was going to end around to his wife, Julie, who was also co-owner of Fox Hollow and could legally authorize a full search of the property.
I would.
The detective found Julie just as stubborn as Herb had been, however. Evidently, Herb had told Julie that he was being falsely accused of theft, and if approached, do not, under any circumstances, allow the police to conduct a search. But when Mary confided...
Why would he lie to her? A theft?
What else is she gonna
say? I mean, she's gotta find out.
I know, because she's about to say it right now. But when Mary confided in the wife, explaining the real reason for their quest, Julie looked at Mary as if she'd just dropped a nuclear bomb in her lap. When she recovered enough to speak again, she informed Detective Mary that they could not search her home. She was polite, but still stunned, almost beyond words. Mary gave Julie her card and urged her to call if she changed her mind. And urged her to please change her fucking mind.
And you need to get the fuck up out of there.
Julie telling the police to politely fuck off didn't indicate her guilt in the slightest. It was a very typical reaction of a codependent wife who lives in denial of marrying a monster. Not just a wife, a spouse in general. Let's not make it misogynist.
Well, yeah, you go defend your mother.
I'll defend my wife.
Yep.
I'll be just like Julie.
You have
so
to.
So you're not searching my fucking place. Not until I get a straight answer from the horse's mouth, anyway.
And they, ain't that why they don't allow the wife to testify against husband?
They're not compelled to testify against their husband. But in Arrested Development, the dad thought it was, they're not allowed to charge the husband and wife with the same crime.
Yeah.
So he really fucked that up.
Motherfuckers are charging with this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, two for one, they call it. Vandegrift, as a private detective, made that career change from sheriff because of how much he hated the waiting game. This period drove him up a wall. Mary Wilson wanted a search warrant, was unable to get one issued because Hamilton County was out of her jurisdiction. Hamilton County detectives, meanwhile, would not cooperate.
Yeah, because they're probably still laughing.
It took 6 whole months for Julie to come to her senses and open the property to investigators. Here's the thing. Hamilton County, they didn't want there to be a serial killer. None of these people do. Nobody wants there to be a serial killer. So, if you pretend it's ridiculous that you think somebody's got 11 dead bodies up in their property, you're going to say, ha, 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 that's not true. You're an idiot. Not in this county, you fucking idiot. Well,
yes, in this county.
Yeah, right in this county.
Like, dude, if it could happen to California, bro, it could happen here.
In those 6 months, Julie's husband had become a paranoid wreck, the linchpin being when the Children's Bureau decided to cancel their contract with the two failing and filthy Save-A-Lots. Home life for Julie was now intolerable, and both she and Herb filed separate divorce proceedings. The codependent spell was broken. She no longer felt loyalty for the monster she'd married. On June 23rd, she called her lawyer, Bill Wendling, and told him to get in touch with Mary Wilson.
Get that bitch over to search this property so I can easily get these kids.
And that's a great idea. Don't call the police. Let the goddamn
lawyer.
That's it. I was trying to think of the people at customs that broker. Like, basically, lawyers are law brokers. That's what they do. They move things along in a safe way for you.
Yep. For you, remember that.
Yep. And to honestly, to make things easier for the prosecution later, because they're thinking about it with the order part in mind and not just the law.
The only reason I say for you, too, because if somebody get you a lawyer, that's really to protect them.
Oh, for sure.
So
for sure. If someone says,
I know you know that.
Oh, hey, I got my, yeah. I got you your counsel. Don't worry about it. Yeah, you got to worry about
go
it.
Go get your own shit, bro. I'm good. I got my own shit, bro. Got to protect my fucking ass,
that means
too.
The shit storm's coming, and it's mm-hmm. that person's fault.
Yeah.
Herb was currently out of town with his son Eric visiting his mother at Lake Wawasee, and Julie wanted to take this opportunity to tell Mary about the bone she had found in the backyard. The following day, after Julie's lawyer notified her, Mary Wilson drove anxiously to Fox Hollow Farms. Accompanying her were two very skeptical Hamilton County officials, Captain Tom Anderson and a detective, Jeff Markham. In truth, Anderson was sure that the human remains Wilson hoped to find would turn out to be animal bones. He was not too shy, even right in Mary's face, to directly call her bullshit.
No, so he was still denying it on the whole drive.
Fuck yeah.
What a scumbag, bro.
Julie Bowmeister, with attorney Wendling at her side, met the law enforcement people at her front door that afternoon and led them through the house to the wooded backyard. There, she pointed to the spot where, 2 years earlier, her son Eric had found that skeleton. The reason she had not notified the authorities until now, she claimed, because she believed Herb's story about the bones being the dissecting skeleton.
Was her lawyer there, too?
Yep.
Okay, cool.
His recent erratic actions, however, filled her with new doubts that maybe that was a skeleton he made. Just glancing over the yard, everything looked normal, but as the men began rummaging through the low grass and dirt patches past the patio, they found a bone about a foot long that was charred from having been burned.
Mm.
They couldn't tell if it was human. As they focused their investigative eyes on the area around the bone, it became apparent that many of the pebbles and rocks they were standing on were actually bone fragments.
Damn!
Julie's lawyer, Bill Wendling, who was watching the police scoop up bones, suddenly looked down at his feet and realized in a chill that he too was standing on bone fragments. And this was the backyard where his children played. There were human teeth and pieces of bone everywhere.
You got to be fucking kidding me. So what, were you just throwing them, these bitches all over the backyard?
Or? Burning them and tossing them.
Just not even burying
them. Scattering them, yep. Still, the county people on site were unconvinced that what they were gathering and taking photographs of were human. On this point, they drastically contended with Mary Wilson. Well, she personally delivered the bags of evidence to forensic anthropologist Stephen Nowrocki at the University of Indiana for examination.
Mm-hmm.
His answer was immediate. They're human, they're recent, and they've been burned.
They motherfucker found a tooth, bro?
Idiots. Human tooth.
Yeah, you still denying this shit?
I think that's probably from a raccoon.
Oh, bro, stop it.
That one right there might be from a Indiana possum.
Look, don't get me wrong, just because you find a tooth. Don't necessarily. It's human, yeah, but it could be somebody's. But this is definitely the suspicion that you need, though. Like, okay, well, we got this.
They're standing on pieces of burned bones.
They wilding out with this, bro.
Yeah, they were standing on pieces of burned bones.
Does y'all still protect this dude because his daddy? Because his daddy dead.
Yeah, way dead.
You ain't got to worry about him no more.
The next day, police returned to the scene of what looked like one of the worst crime scenes Indiana ever encountered.
Mm.
It began to appear now that Herbert Bowmeister's homemade graveyard might contain the remains of those many young homosexuals who, over several years, had vanished from the streets of Indy.
Mm-hmm.
While the dig continued into the late hours, other policemen checked out the interior of the Bowmeister home. They found the mannequins, the wet bar, the pool, just as the acquaintance had described them. However, they uncovered something that he had not seen the evening of his encounter with Bowmeister, a semi-hidden video camera that the police immediately suspected had been used to tape the strangulations.
Mm.
The case was turning more bizarre hourly.
Mm.
County interrogators, led by Sheriff's Detective Kenneth Wiseman, were beginning to put the pieces of the Bowmeister puzzle together. Compost piles yielded heavy degree of bones where it appeared the killer had burned his corpses under piles of leaves and garbage. A big question they had, how could Herb have strangled and burned and buried all these men without his family's knowledge?
Yeah,
well, this was answered in an interview with Julie herself.
Mm-hmm.
She explained that sometimes, for several months at a time, especially during the summers, she and the children visited the widow Bowmeister, leaving Herb alone at home.
That's true. A few weeks at a time, you did say that.
Balancing the times of the victim's disappearances with the periods she and her kids were away, the incidences matched up perfectly.
Mm, look at them.
Brilliant.
Mm. Hey, wouldn't you be mad if you was a detective thinking, oh, this is going to be nothing. I'm only going to be here 30 minutes. I'll be right back out. We're going to be back smoking some bud in a minute. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you find this... you find that you're like, dude, now I'm here for a whole 16 fucking hours.
You got to think about these county guys. Mm. How many times they had to double down? They had to say, boy, that 2 foot bone, that's from a crocodile or something. Then they find human teeth. Man, that's from a different crocodile. You're doubling down over and over.
That's just don't want to work.
That's probably what it is. That's what I say. I'm like, that's not a scratch. That's a.
It's fine.
That's some. That's
it's
like
smudge.
A, yep. Mm-hmm. The customer won't even notice.
Yeah.
The first couple days, search had produced an amazing 5,500 bones, teeth, and bone fragments, which made up about 4 bodies. After they had combed the entire 18.5 acres of property, members of the team were soon to learn that their search was far from over.
Mm.
Neighbors from an adjacent farm crossed into the police cordon to inform them that they had found evidence of yet more bones on their property.
Like, nah, y'all try to blame y'all murders on him. We not doing that shit. You motherfuckers get, y'all getting arrested. Did they arrest him too? Probably not.
No. They led investigators to an area cut through with a drainage ditch that separated the two properties. Here in this ditch were so many human ribs, vertebrae, and spines that one of the officials murmured, Jesus Christ, they're everywhere. The bones were so numerous and more intact than on the Baumeister land that they actually stuck up visibly from the mud. Shovels drew up not only more bones, but with them cans of Miller Genuine Draft Beer, which was Herb's favorite drink.
I wonder another question.
Also handcuffs that had probably bound the victims in death.
Man. So... for them to, I wonder what made them look on their property. Did they see
Well, they
dude?
Probably came over to where the police tape was, said, I wonder what the fuck's going on over at Baumeister Farm, and then tripped over a rib cage and went, well, that ain't supposed to be there.
Hey, I think we got some... Well, they were just smart enough. Oh, shit. They
bring the rib cages.
Man, hurry up. Let's put our bodies on him. Hell yeah, that's a smart-ass plan.
By the time exhumation of this area ended, and by the time that the 140 bones were estimated as those belonging to another 7 men, the mortal count had risen to estimatedly 11 total killed. It would be September before the anthropologists were able to identify some of the bodies. Disappointingly, only 4 in each of these gathered from dental records. The 4 positively ID'd victims were Roger Allen Goodlett, age 34, Stephen Hale, age 26, Richard Hamilton, age 20, and Manuel Resendez, age 31. 4 more would be identified much later. John Lee Bayer, age 20, Jeffrey A. Jones, age 31, Alan Wayne Broussard, age 28, and Michael Frederick Kiern, age 46. The other 3 will probably remain un-ID'd forever.
Well, they got them. All they do, that's all they need is those 4 bodies, but like we
charge.
All, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, like you always say, it's what about the closure?
The families.
That's the sucky part.
Fuck yeah. When your child died and you get nothing, you get bupkis. You have no idea still.
You don't know where it's at.
And it could be one of those 3 sets of bones that's still unidentified, and you're never going to know.
Nope.
But where was Herb? He'd ran from his mother's place and seemed to disappear just like his victims. The only lead police had to go on came from Herb's brother, Brad Baumeister, who called 5 days after police found the graveyard. Brad told the cops that his older brother had called him from the tiny Michigan town of Fenville, saying he was on a business trip and needed some quick cash. After Brad wired it, he became aware of the shit show at his brother's property and called police. Ontario Provincial Police believed Herb arrived in Sarnia, Ontario on June 30th, spending several days there before driving east along Lake Huron shoreline to Grand Bend, Ontario. There, at Piney Park, on the evening of July 3rd, Herb would take his last life. He put a .357 Magnum revolver to his forehead and pulled the trigger. The note he left behind attributed his decision to his failing business and irreparable marriage, but there was no mention of the skeletons left behind him in Westfield.
And ultimately, that's why he killed it, though.
That's exactly why.
He knew...
The dragnet was here.
Yeah, that shit was predetermined, too. Mm-hmm. He knew what he was doing if he'd get caught. He had to get caught. He didn't do very well on hiding this shit.
His kids were playing lightsabers with femurs, probably.
Look, man, this dude is left it on his property. Like, come on, man, you don't think...
You're a sick shit fuck that doesn't care about nobody but you.
Indeed, he was bringing the victims to your crib.
And he's a closeted homosexual, which is likely where all this rage comes from. Instead, his final words on the 3-page suicide document explained that he would now eat a peanut butter sandwich, his favorite snack, and then go to sleep. The evening before he died, a Canadian trooper had stopped him to ask why he was sleeping in his car under a bridge. He told her that he was merely a tourist passing through and was grabbing a moment's rest. At that time, she noticed some luggage and what looked like a pile of videotapes in his back seat. Were these videotapes of the murders he committed in the pool at Fox Hollow Farms?
Mm-hmm.
We will never know, for after he died, there was no signs of the tapes on him or the car. He must have tossed them in a lake before he shot himself.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps that's for the best.
No, no, because she said it's a shit pile of videotapes. That means that was probably from Ohio, Indiana.
Let's talk about this. Her Bomeister.
The Bobes.
Was never... There's a possibility that he killed 23 people, Herschel, and there was no conviction, no nothing. You see, early in his investigations, Van de Griff made connections between the disappearances of gay men in Indianapolis to the strangling murders of homosexuals whose bodies were found dumped along I-70 in the state of Ohio. In sharing the acquaintance's testimony with David Lindelof, a prosecutor from Ohio, he was heading the investigation of what was called the I-70's murders. The two men agreed that there were tight similarities. The last known I-70 murder had been committed in 1990, not long before the Indianapolis disappearances began. Bomeister's photo matched the police sketch drawn from witnesses who had thought they'd seen the I-70 strangler. One eyewitness, in fact, even came forward to identify Herb's picture as that of the same man who had driven his friend home from a bar one evening in 1988. His friend Michael Riley had been found dead the next morning. Not long after, representatives from combined Ohio and Indiana communities held a press conference to definitely link Bomeister with the I-70 slayings. So he is definitely linked, but it'll never be proven.
You see, because how they was treating it at first, like, oh, it's not it. Yeah. That's like, let's just add this to this so we can ease everybody's minds.
You think so?
It could be, if they was acting like that way before.
I mean, geez. How many gay stranglers? I mean,
this was the 90s,
like,
too.
How many gay stranglers have I covered at this point, though? I think...
All of them.
I think maybe two with you now. Three with you, maybe.
I said all of them.
Did, like, four with Cody. So it's like, all have pretty similar MOs as far as strangulation goes. So who knows? Maybe they did want to make Ohio feel safer and say that guy wouldn't be coming back because he shot himself. Yeah.
Are you saying that he might have actually beat that, though?
No. Not with all the bones recovered. But the thing is, he was never officially charged with anything. They never arrest them, yeah. I don't think they would.
Okay, they didn't charge because they didn't arrest him.
That's right. Like,
okay.
They couldn't find
him. My bad.
He was on the lam, as they call it. Well, listen, Herb, that was Herb.
Yeah.
That was another Herb. Herbert Bomeister.
You gotta stop calling me Herb.
I know, I'm gonna have to now. Now that we've done 2 and 3 weeks. All right, Herschel. That was fantastic. Thanks for coming over for another episode of Bumble Butt Podcast X. I've been Adam.
H-Bomb.
It's been H-Bomb. And we'll see you next week.
Yeah.
For another episode. And you know what I mean? Just chill.
Yep.
In the DeVille. We'll see you. Bye. Yep.